In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate. Good evening. As my friend Jamal pointed out, the title of my presentation is Five Signs of Surrender to God. I will initially talk about the concept of surrender itself. What does it mean when we say, I surrender to God? And after that, I will briefly talk about the five major signs of surrender to God. So let's begin with the introduction. Surrender, or taslim in Arabic and Farsi, is the bedrock of Abrahamic faiths. In fact, a Muslim is someone who surrenders to God. Muslim, with lowercase m, is theology neutral, which means followers of Abraham, Isaac, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad all surrender to God. So the path of surrendering to God is open to everyone. Do not confuse surrender to God with acceptance of certain theological doctrines. They are not the same thing. A person might have a very strong opinion, strong convictions in God and religious dogma, and at the same time, he has no notion or concept of surrendering to God. Surrender, in a nutshell, is all about control. It's all about control. Who is in control of our life and behavior? When we surrender to God, in effect, we take control away from certain forces that drag us down in life, that they create tension inside us. They incite us to trample over the rights of other people, or in a nutshell, do evil. The question is, what are these forces? Who are these so-called agents? In the Quranic terminology, it would be our nafs, or the lower self, or in psychology these days, the unrefined ego. That's what we are trying to surrender. So, in a sense, surrendering to God is synonymous with surrendering these forces or agents so that they will have no control over us anymore. So once we are free from the control of these forces that drag us down, we will truly be free. Now we open up to a new universe of ideas, feelings, and experiences that we could not have before. So essentially, this is what we call surrender to God. So let me clarify. Do not conceive of surrendering to God as when you surrender to a political authority or when you surrender to a king. It's not the same thing. I know that the very notion of surrender sounds quite scary to modern folks, because they may think that surrender implies imprisonment. Well, that's not the case. When we surrender to God, we are not imprisoned. On the contrary, it is a prelude to our freedom. True, when we surrender, first we need to break before God. So surrender initially means breaking before God. But this breakage is not humiliation. It's a prelude to reconstruction. In other words, when we break in front of God, that's an attempt to reconstruct our life. That will make us a better person. It will elevate us to a higher state of existence and being. Let's listen to Rumi and how beautifully he puts it when we break in front of God. Ez qeyrat bar sabu sangi zade وان سبوز شکست کامل تر شده، خم شکسته آب از او ناریخته، صد درستی زین شکست انگیخته. او یو هو فرام جلسی هز هرد ای ستون ات دی جگ، وایل دی جگ هز اونلی بیکام مور پرفکت ثرو بیکامینگ شاترد. The jar is shattered, but the water is not spilled from it. From this shattering have arisen 100 soundness. Can you think of it? When a jar is shattered, that it would become more perfect? That's what happens when you break in front of God. Obviously, Rumi is talking about a paradox. A jar is shattered but not destroyed. Its capacity miraculously increases. This is exactly what happens when we break before God. Our capacity for goodness and for beauty increases. Let me also make a point here. Surrender is far, far more than obedience. Intentionally, I didn't use the word submission tonight. I didn't say five signs of submission. There is a great difference between submission and surrender. They are not interchangeable. Submission brings to mind obedience, right? Whereas surrender is far more than obedience. It's far more than obeying God's commandments, do's and don'ts. Far more than observing formal religious practices. Surrender will impact our whole being. It will impact our heart, our mind, and our soul. In this way, God practically takes control over our whole existence, our heart, mind, and soul. So, in a sense, surrender or taslim will deeply impact our whole existence and will redefine who we are. That's what happens when you truly surrender to God. It redefines who you are. And quite naturally, some signs will appear in your character and in your personality. Surrender to God always accompanies certain signs. These signs will appear quite naturally, gradually but naturally, in a person's soul, mind, and heart. Tonight, inshallah, I will talk about five major signs of surrender to God. There are a lot more signs, but because we have limited time in this presentation tonight, I will restrict my discussion to five major signs. These signs are actually good barometers to measure our surrender to God. As people of faith, we all claim or are hopeful that we are surrendering to God. Are we? Have we? Let's consider these signs. Now, these signs, you should use them as yardstick to gauge yourself and not your neighbor. Because that's one of the major flaws that a lot of religious people have. They take the religious and sacred texts, be it the Quran, the Bible, or whatever, and they use it in order to judge and measure their neighbor. But in fact, this holy book should be used to judge your own character and personality. So when I talk about these five major signs of surrender, it's to judge ourselves and not the person next door. As I mentioned earlier, surrender is a path open to everybody, to all people, irrespective of the theological doctrines they subscribe to or the temple that they visit. Tonight I will make references to the Holy Quran, but whatever I say equally applies to Christianity and Judaism. I could easily draw my references from the Holy Bible as well. I will draw heavily upon the teachings of Rumi. His teachings are captured in his masterpiece, Mathnavi, or the couplets. Mathnavi is, in the Farsi language, it's a book of poetry, a fascinating, really beautiful work of poetry. Inshallah, tonight, I will always recite Rumi's poems in the original language, Farsi, and then I will translate it into English. Unfortunately, no one can translate the beauty of Rumi's poetry into English. Those of you who are proficient in the Farsi language, I'm sure you're going to savor the beauty of the poetry as well. So, let me begin with the signs of surrender to God. The first one, khushu. Khushu is an emotional state. It's an emotional state, and it shows up in our heart. That's what it shows. We will feel profound humility before God. So khushu signifies a humble heart. So the first sign of surrender to God is a humble heart. A heart that has been touched and humbled by God. A humble heart is not visible to the people outside. So do not look at somebody and try to judge whether his or her heart is humbled by God or not. Only the person herself and God could possibly be aware of the humbleness of the heart. Yet, it is the best indicator of God's presence in a person. The best indicator of God's presence and dwelling in a person is the humility of the heart. In the story of Moses and Shepherd in Mathnavi, Rumi sets up a fictional story to make this very point. According to the story, one day Moses saw a shepherd who was talking and praying to God in a very awkward and bizarre way. دید موسی یک شبانی را به راه کو همین گفته گزیننده اله تو کجایی تا شوم من چاکرت چارقت دوزم کنم شان سرت جامعت شویم شپشهایت کشم شیر پیشت آورم ای محتشم دستکت بوسب بمالم پایکت وقت خواب آید بروبم جایکت ای فدای تو همه بزهای من ای بیادت هی هی و هی های من O God, where are you? I want to help you to fix your shoes and comb your hair. I want to wash your clothes and pick the lice off. I want to bring you milk to kiss your little hands and feet when it is time for you to go to bed. I want to sweep your room and keep it neat. God, all my sheep and goats are yours. Understandably, Moses, being the messenger of God, was extremely upset. He protested to the shepherd and said, Are you talking to your uncle or God? What kind of language is this? God doesn't have hands and feet. God doesn't sleep. So anyhow, this is a long story. Halfway through the story, God intervenes and teaches Moses, his messenger, a very basic yet a profound lesson. Listen to it. This is God teaching his messenger a lesson about faith. ما زبان را ننگریم و قال را ما درون را بنگریم و حال را، ناظر قلبیم اگر خاشع بود، گرچه گفت لفظ ناخاضع رود. God says, I look not at the tongue and the speech. I look at the inward spirit and the state of the feeling. I gaze into the heart to see whether it be lowly, though the words uttered be not lowly. In other words, faith does not grow on tongue. It grows in heart. That's the lesson that God's messenger Moses received from God. And that's where khushu' will emerge. That's where khushu' will reside, in the heart. Now the question is, how does exactly khushu' or humble heart come about? Right? So that's a good question. How do we attain this state of humility of heart before God? Let me spend a few minutes and explain that. You see, sometimes we experience a situation where we cannot dominate, we cannot overcome, we have to throw in the towel. It could be a terrible illness, loss of a loved one, financial ruin, war. In any of these circumstances, there is no chance of winning, right? We feel like we are beaten. Rumi likens this kind of a situation to the experience of a lame deer that faces a lion. Can you picture that? A lame deer facing a lion. ای رفیقان، راه ها را بست یار، آهوی لنگیم و او شیر شکار. جز که تسلیم و رضا کو چاره ای، در کف شیر نری خونخاره ای. Oh comrades, the beloved has barred the ways. We are lame deer and he a hunting lion. For one who is in the clutch of a fierce, bloodthirsty lion, where is any resource except resignation and acquiescence? That's what happens when we have grand experiences in life. Crushing experiences in life really make us feel small in the grand scheme of things. These experiences shatter our illusions. The illusion that we are invincible, we are unbreakable, unbeatable, and we are far superior to everybody else. The experience of God is exactly like that. It's a shattering experience. We cannot dominate God. You can never, ever overcome God, right? There are two gates in this whole world that once you reach it, if you are very tall and proud, you have to bend and bow. One gate is the gate of God, and the second gate is death. You can never, ever overcome these two. And both of these will crush you. It will have crushing experiences in you. But this crush, as I mentioned, do you remember that the jar that was shattered? This crushing is not to destroy you, it's to reconstruct you, to make you a better person, more whole. Now, the awareness that comes from such humbling experiences in the Quranic usage of the term is called khashyat. Khashyat. It's an awareness. Now, sometimes khashyat is translated into English as fear. So khashyat would be the fear of God. And this is absolutely incorrect. Khashyat doesn't mean fear, or at least not khashyat of God. For the following reason, when you fear somebody, Do you go to that person or do you run away from him? Does God want to frighten us so we run away from him? Or does he want to get our attention and invite us to himself? So khashyat doesn't mean fear. You should, in the true sense of the term, you should never fear God. Because whenever you have fear, you are going to run away from the person who is frightening you. Right? So khashyat doesn't mean fear. God wants to have our total attention. Khashyat should be translated into English as awe. Awe. It's an overwhelming feeling of reverence and admiration when we encounter something that is grand, that is sublime, that is extremely powerful. So not only God does not frighten us, he makes us at ease and at peace. In a sense, paradoxically, we are drawn to the very same person that makes us feel small and insignificant, that make us feel like we cannot overcome him. We find ourselves as if we are in a magnetic field. That's what happens when you encounter God. All the prophets of God, all the mystics, that's what they're reporting when they say we encountered God. They say we felt like we were in a magnetic field. We could not escape from that, right? God evokes two conflicting feelings in us. The feeling of awe and fascination. These are two conflicting feelings that God evokes in us. Consider how the Holy Quran describes and portrays God. It's really beautiful. إِنَّمَا تُنْزِرُ مَنِ اتَّبِعَ الذِّكْرَ وَخَشِيَ الرَّحْمَانَ بِالْقَيْدِ. This verse is addressed to the Prophet Muhammad. O Prophet, you can warn only those who will follow the Quran and hold the Merciful One in awe. خَشِيَ الرَّحْمَانَ, the one who is awesome, the one who makes us feel impotent and very weak, the one that demands respect from us. At the same time, he is merciful, he is loving, and he is compassionate. So these are the two conflicting feelings that we get in from God is really captured in this phrase. خَشْيَ الرَّحْمَانَ, the one that humbles you, is also extremely loving and compassionate. Not only God doesn't frighten us and doesn't make us run away from him, he captivates us. He captivates us with his grace. Remember Rumi's analogy of that lame deer who was in the clutch of a bloodthirsty lion? Now this deer is transformed by the grace of God. He no longer fears the lion. He longs for the lion. He puts himself in all sorts of dangers. He puts himself in 100 traps so he would have a glimpse of the lion, or in this case, God, who is the majestic beloved. Let's listen to Rumi describing the feelings and the longings of this transformed deer. دل من رای تو دارد، سر سودای تو دارد، رخ فرسوده زردم غم صفرای تو دارد، ز تو هر هدیه که بردم به خیال تو سپردم، که خیال شکرینت فر و سیمای تو دارد. اگرم در نگشایی ز ره بام برایم، که زهی جان لطیفی که تماشای تو دارد. به 200 بام برایم، به 200 دام درایم، چه کنم آهوی جانم سر صحرای تو دارد. This is how Rumi describes the feeling of this transformed deer who's been touched by the love and the grace of the good Lord. My heart longs for you. If you do not open the door, I will come in from the roof just to have a glimpse of you. What can I do? My soul is like a deer that yearns to be in your field. That's what I mean by God evoking two distinct feelings in us, awe and fascination, right? And fascination. So to summarize, khushu is an emotional state. It's an emotional state that settles in the heart when we surrender to God. It's a combination of awe, reverence, and humility before God. So that is what a humble heart would look like, right? Again, this humble heart is not visible to the outside world. It's something that we experience and feel inside. The second sign of surrender to God, Ridha in Arabic and Farsi. Ridha. It's a bit a challenge to find a word in the English language for Ridha. In Arabic, Ridha comes from the root word raziyat, which means to be pleased, to be satisfied, and to be content, right? So the closest word in the English language for Ridha is contentment. Contentment. The key ingredient of Ridha is satisfaction. So it goes far beyond acceptance of something. It involves embracing, right? So it's not just acceptance of a situation and reality, but it's all about embracing it. Sometimes we have an unpleasant experience in life. Since we feel helpless and we can't change reality, the reality, we have to accept it, right? We have no other choice. This is not called Ridha, right? This is truly is not called contentment when you feel you have no choice but to accept the reality, right? It's not the same thing. We may resign, acknowledge, we may concede and comply, but there is still some reservation. There is tension. See that, you remember initially I said surrender is not the same thing as submission. You can submit to God, but really won't be pleased with everything that happens to you, right? There is always a sense of tension that I wish things were different. I wish this hadn't happened to me. But since I'm a person of faith, I have to accept it, right? That's not what Ridha means. That's not what contentment means. When we surrender to God, our Creator, the all-knowing, all-powerful, we acquire a new mental state. We embrace the challenges and difficulties in life at God's will, at God's plan for us. So we don't have any reservations anymore. There won't be any tension anymore if you truly have this new state of mind. Contentment has quite a few faces, right? There are a lot of different manifestations to contentment. Let me give you a couple of examples so you truly grasp what Ridha in real life would look like. So let me give you a couple of examples. The first one. A person who has Ridha or has contentment will face loss gracefully. We all, every day, have losses. They come in different shapes, forms, and stripes, right? So a person who has contentment will face losses gracefully. A loss may be financial, it may be a relationship, it may be a job opportunity, or it could be a loved one. You see, this world we live in, and everything in it is impermanent. So I want to tell you why we have losses. Everything in this world, by definition, is impermanent. It's fleeting. In the Holy Quran, ad-dunya means something that is perishable, something that is fleeting, right? That is the essence and nature of the natural world. Everything dies. So, all comforts, riches, and blessings are prone to going away. Even though they do not last, the provider is everlasting. The benefit is short-lived, but the beneficent is everlasting. There is a Sufi story that I believe really captures the essence of what I'm trying to convey to you about this phase of contentment, accepting loss and facing losses gracefully. This Sufi story belongs to Shafiq Balkhi, who was a Sufi Muslim that lived about 1200 years ago. During Shafiq's time, one year there was severe drought and famine. People experienced a lot of hardships. They cried and prayed to God for rain. One day Shafiq saw a domestic servant who was very jubilant. He had a big smile on his face. Shafiq approached the servant and said, "What is it with this big smile on your face? Wipe it off. Don't you see all the pain and suffering of the people? Can't you see how unforgiving and unkind this world has been to our people?" The servant said, "What do I know of unkindness and punishment, since I belong to a master that has two warehouses full of grains? I am not afraid. I know that he will not forget me or leave me in despair." He said, "Why should I despair? Why should I not be happy? Because my master has two warehouses full of grains." As Rumi said it the best, absolutely the best. چه شکر فروش دارم که به من شکر فروشد که نگفت از روزی که برو شکر ندارم. There is one store in this world. There is one store in this world that any time you go in and ask for sugar, the shopkeeper will never tell you, "Sorry, we are out of sugar. Go and come back tomorrow." And that store belongs to God, our sustainer, our provider. There is always sugar and sweetness in his store. That's the attitude that somebody like Rumi has. And I submit to you, if you have this attitude in life, losses and hardships will never shake you. You will never crumble under the weight of hardship and losses in life. You will never despair. You will always have hope. When you have God, it means you always have hope. Brothers and sisters, contentment grows out of hope. That's where contentment comes from, because you're hopeful, right? If you are hopeful that God will never leave you alone in hardships, you will be content at whatever is thrown at you. The second example of contentment, it has to do with, in Arabic and Farsi, what we call the rizq, or fortunes, blessings, and endowments, right? When you have contentment, you are content with the blessings, endowments, and fortunes that you have. no matter what the level of the fortunes are. The level is immaterial. You are truly at peace with whatever you have at that very moment in life. I know that this is absolutely a tough pill to swallow for folks living in a capitalist society, where you're always encouraged from birth to be greedy, to envy, to covet, right? That's what keeps the rat race going, right? That's what keeps the system functioning, greed. In the context of rizq, contentment has two important requirements. You want to be content with what you have, because without contentment, you can never be happy. Let me make it very plain and clear to you. If you are content with whatever you have at this very moment in life, you will never be happy. You want to have that feeling of contentment? There are two requirements. No shortcuts. No shortcuts. Always remember from your humble brother these two requirements for happiness. Number one, requirement number one. This is very important for the younger folks in the audience, right? For the younger folks. Do not accept arbitrary measures for success. Do not accept any arbitrary measures the society sets for you for success. Like all these standardized tests that we have out there for intelligence, for maturity. That is absolutely nonsense. Don't believe them. There is no one size fits all. This kind of attitude is a recipe for despair in life. Incorrectly, we often create a yardstick or a bar for success. If you clear that bar, you are successful. If you don't clear it, you're a failure. Isn't that what we're told day in and day out? Right? That's a recipe for disaster. Success should never be defined as something that is like a one-size-fits-all. Rather, success should be defined as the best you can do, the best you can be. That is the definition of success. Not how you should measure yourself against everybody else in society. That's what especially the modern capitalist society teaches us. That's how we become greedy, right? When I look at my neighbor next door, because I'm taught that I should always measure myself with the person next door, if I don't have it, I want to have it also to be successful. That's a recipe for failure and unhappiness in life. Requirement number two, do not be greedy. Do not be greedy, do not covet. Contentment means coming to terms with your endowments, coming to terms with your God-given abilities and talents, coming to terms with that. Utilize your talents to their full potential and leave it at that. If you do that, you are successful in life. There is a caveat to what I just said. Do not let your desires exceed your capacity. Right? Do not let your desires exceed your capacity. Isn't that what the Holy Quran teaches us? La yukallifu Allahu nafsan illa wus'aha. Right? That's essentially another way of saying what the Quran teaches us. If your desires exceed your capacity, you know what's going to happen? You have to cheat. You have to break all the rules in the book in order to make sure that your desires come to fruition. So, contentment or raza is the second sign of surrender to God. The third sign, tawakkul. Tawakkul or trusting God. Tawakkul or trust is the third sign of surrender to God. Tawakkul goes hand in hand with surrender. In surrendering to God, He becomes our sustainer. We lean on Him. We rely on Him. We trust that our all-powerful and gracious sustainer will keep His promises. Right? That's what we put our faith and confidence in. We are confident that this all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving sustainer will keep His promises to us. Let me address a widespread confusion about trusting God and tawakkul. This confusion is widespread in religious circles. Some folks incorrectly take trusting God to mean being passive. They incorrectly put the responsibility for their lives in God's hands, right? It's as if now God is supposed to think for them and act on their behalf. They call their laziness trusting God. That is not what trusting God and tawakkul means. Let's listen to Rumi. گر توکل می کنی در کار کن کشت کن پس تکیه بر جبار کن. If you are putting your trust in God, put trust in Him as regards your work. Sow the seed, then rely upon the Almighty. First plant the seed and then put your trust in God. Don't sit on the couch and ask God to plant the seed in your behalf. And I submit to you that's what a lot of religious people do all over the world. Trusting God is a call for action, not a justification for inaction, right? It doesn't mean leaving things to chance and calling it destiny. Isn't that what we do? We leave everything to chance, and when something happens as a result of it, we say that was our destiny. That's not what tawakkul or trust in God is all about. The Quran is absolutely clear on that. This verse is also addressed to the person of the Prophet Muhammad. وَشَاوِرُهُمْ فِي الْأَمْرِ فَإِذَا أَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ الْمُتَوَكِّلِينَ. Again, it's addressed to the Prophet. Consult with people about matters. Then, when you have decided on a course of action, put your trust in God. God loves those who put their trust in Him. So it's very clear. First, put your heads together. Do cost-benefit analysis. Come up with a game plan. And when the time comes for implementation, then put your trust in God. In that order. Usually we jump all the way to the third step. And that's wrong. That's the definition, the classic definition of laziness. Now, the smart ones in the audience might say, if we are supposed to rely on our brain power and hard work, what's the use of trusting God? What's the use of it if I am the actor, if I'm supposed to be doing all the work? The answer is very simple. Rational decision making is super important. We should do that. But it is not sufficient. Courage and decisiveness is also very important in order to carry out our plans in life. Again, I think Rumi's teaching is absolutely great in this regard. در هزار شوریدن شور و شر است رو توکل کن توکل بهتر است. In excessive caution is the embroilment of broil and woo. Go, put your trust in God. Trust in God is better. The critical word in this phrase is hazar. Hazar means caution. Caution, so pervasive that leads to fear and anxiety. You see, sometimes we are so cautious, we are so overly cautious, that then we end up having anxiety and fear about what we want to do. This type of attitude and feeling would have a crippling effect on you. It will create misgivings and will impede our ability to carry through with our plans in life. That's where tawakkul comes in. That's where trusting God comes in. The function of trust in God is to enable us overcome hesitation and fear of the unknown. Right? To overcome hesitation and fear of the unknown. When you put your trust in the all-powerful God, you will have no fear. You will have no fear. God is far bigger than any challenge that you might face when you want to implement your plans. So, one of the fruits of tawakkul is courage and determination. You will have guts when you have trust in God. You will have guts to embark on huge projects in life. You will become a risk taker. You become a risk taker, particularly in cases where there is no guarantee for success, where it is necessary for you to take a leap of faith. Have you heard of this phrase, leap of faith? Leap of faith is only possible for people who put their trust in God. Right? Leap of faith is only a path available to people who put their trust in God. Now let me talk about the fourth sign of surrender to God. In Arabic and Farsi, tawadhu, tawadhu, or in English, modesty. Modesty, or tawadhu, is the fourth sign of surrender. The Quran identifies modesty as a sign of surrender to God. وَعِبَادُ الرَّحْمَانَ الَّذِينَ يَمْشَوْنَ عَنَ الْأَرْضِ حَوْنًا وَإِذَا خَاتَبَهُمُ الْجَاهِلُونَ قَالُوا سَلَامًا. The servants of the Lord of Mercy are those who walk humbly, who walk humbly on the earth, and who, when the foolish address them, reply, peace. Right? When the foolish insult them, they reply, peace be unto you. Tawadhu comes from the root word wada'a in Arabic language, which means to put down or to cast down. When a woman is pregnant and she delivers her baby, what do we say in Farsi? What do we say in Farsi? Vaz-e haml, which means the pregnant woman put down her load, right? She had a big load, she put it down. Vaz-e haml. The question for you is this: what does a Muslim, someone who surrenders to God, put down? What does a submitter, a surrenderer to God, put down? His pride, vanity, and arrogance. That's what you put down when you surrender to God. The very quality that impedes surrendering to God, right? The arrogant can never surrender. The arrogant can never surrender. Rumi has an astonishing teaching. He says the following in Masnavi: God created us from a fabric that lends itself to be modest. The fabric from which we are created lends itself to modesty. Question for you: what did God make us out of? What? The Holy Quran. We have the same concept in the Holy Bible, by the way. فَإِنَّا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ مِنْ تُرَابٍ. We created you from dust. We created you from dust. Now listen to Rumi. ای که جزو این زمینی سر مکش چون که بینی حکم یزدان در مکش چون خلقناکم شنودی من تراب خاک باشی جست از تو رومتا. The Farsi translation for تواضع is خاک باشی، خاکی بودن. Did you know that? خاک باشی. Right. O you who are part of this earth, do not lift up your head in rebellion. When you see the decree of God, do not withdraw from it disobediently. Since you have heard we created you from dust, know that God has required you to be humble as dust. Do not avert your face from him. Since you are from this earth, be down to earth. That's the meaning of what Rumi is teaching us. Since you are made from this earth, be down to earth. Rumi correctly introduces a yardstick. I'm very fond of yardsticks, by the way. Because without yardsticks, we cannot really measure our success in whatever we do, right? So here in this poem, Rumi gave us a yardstick to measure our humanity. What is that yardstick? What is the yardstick we should measure ourselves with to find out how human we are? What is that yardstick? Modesty. Modesty. The more modest you are, the more human you are. People who are arrogant, they don't have much humanity in them. That's why they create all the pain and suffering in the world. Modesty is fertile ground for a lot of blessings. So don't think that modesty is just a nicety, something nice to have. No. Modesty is like a fertile ground. A lot of good flowers come out of this fertile ground of modesty. Let's listen to Rumi again. از بهاران کی شود سرسبز سنگ خاک شو تا گل برویی رنگ رنگ سالها تو سنگ بودی دلخراش آزمون را یک زمانی خاک باش. How should a rock be covered with green vegetation by the spring? Become earth, that you may grow flowers of many colors in the spring. Isn't that fascinating? That if you want to grow flowers, you have to be of the same kind of material as the earth, not the rock. The arrogant are like rocks. Nothing good will ever grow out of their character and their personality. So, if modesty takes root in a person, so many blessings and benefits will follow. Let me give you a few benefits that come out of modesty. Number one, guidance. Guidance. The single most important blessing for a person of faith is guidance. Am I exaggerating? Absolutely not. A person of faith, whether it be a Jew, a Christian, a Zoroastrian, what have you, the single most important blessing that she will have in life is guidance from God. Muslims pray 5 times a day. When we pray, what do we ask from God in our daily prayer? There is only a single thing that we ask from God. First, we set the stage. We tell God how majestic, loving, kind, and great He is. And then we say, Iyyaka na'bud. It is you alone that we worship. فَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ We only ask help from you. Now the stage is set to ask God for a favor. We plead to God. What do we plead for? اِهْدِنَا الصِّرَاطَ الْمُسْتَقِيمَ Guide us to the straight path. That's the single thing that a Muslim asks God 5 times a day. Guide him. I have news for you though. Not so simple. Guidance has a requirement. What's the requirement for guidance? It's modesty. Modesty. If one is arrogant and full of pride, he will never ask for or accept guidance because he is under the illusion that he is all-knowing. He's got it all. He has everything. Why do I need guidance? What do I want to become? I'm full, I'm whole, right? So an arrogant person would never seek guidance. So that's the first fruit of modesty. The second one, modesty makes it easier to admit wrongdoing, to admit fault and defect. In religious language, we call it tawbah, repentance. Only people who are modest can repent. And without repentance, there is no hope for character improvement. You can never become a better person unless you admit that you have faults, you have shortcomings, you have weaknesses in life. An arrogant person can never be reformed because he is stuck in his self-delusion, right? An arrogant person can never be reformed. Modesty makes it easier to forgive. You like forgiveness? Especially if you're Christians? I have news for you. You can never be able to forgive unless you are modest. Modesty makes it easier to show compassion and love. Only the modest can love. They can only love if they are modest. Also, modesty makes it easier to build bridges and have peace. An arrogant person is not able to be a peacemaker, is not capable of loving, is not capable of forgiving. It's getting late. Let me give you the last sign of surrender. I'm going to close the lecture. The fifth sign of surrender. Sulh. Sulh. Or peace in English. Peace. This is my favorite. Right? This is my favorite. One of the major signs of surrender is peace. Peace is actually the other side of surrender. After surrender, peace will emerge. You might ask how. How does peace emerge after we surrender? Let me briefly explain the mechanism. In Abrahamic faiths, Satan is the symbol of rebellion, right? According to the Bible and the Quran, Satan was the very first person who disobeyed God. You remember the story of the creation of Adam and Eve? Satan was so arrogant, he did not succumb to God's order. Satan did not bow to Adam. So what does this arrogant Satan do best? What is Satan's chief mission in life? According to the Quran, إِنَّ الشَّيْطَانَ يَنْزَقُ بَيْنَهُمْ Satan sows discord among people. So Satan sows tension, hatred, and conflict among people. So if rebellion and disobedience leads to tension and conflict, what would lead to peace? The opposite of disobedience and rebellion, which is surrender. Do you see how the formula works out? That's how it works out. Rumi's advice for us. صلح کن با این پدر آقی بحل تا که فرش زر نماید آب و گل. Make peace with this father. Abandon disobedience, that the water and clay, the world, may appear to you as a carpet of gold. In other words, make peace with God. Harmonize yourself with God's will, wisdom, design, and game plan. Harmony will ease tensions, will ease conflicts. It will extinguish the ravaging fires inside us and outside us. When the fire of hatred and animosity is put down, paradise will emerge. Paradise is a place where there is no fire, by definition. Hell, the way it is portrayed in theology, is a place where there is raging fire, right? When all the fires are put out and they are extinguished, paradise will emerge. And that's exactly how the Quran describes the paradise to us. إِنَّ الْمُتَّقِينَ فِي جَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونَ اُدْخُلُوهَا بِسَلَامٍ آمِنِينَ وَنَزَعْنَا مَا فِي صُدُورِهِمْ مِنْ قِلٍّ إِخْوَانًا عَلَى سُرُرٍ مُتَقَابِلِينَ. The righteous will be in paradise. Enter them in peace and safety, and we shall remove any bitterness from their hearts. They will be like brothers sitting on couches, face to face. Paradise is where there is no conflict, there is no hatred, there is no animosity. Paradise is where there is absolute peace, harmony, and love. And by the way, paradise is not a place. It is a state of existence. It's a state of being. It's a state of heart, mind, and soul. As Rumi says, من که صلحم دایمن با این پدر این جهان چون جنت استم در نظر. Since I am ever at peace with this father, this world is like a paradise in my sight. So Rumi says, I do not need to die and wait for a few thousand years to be judged and then sent to heaven, to paradise. I'm already in heaven, in this life, on earth. Why? Here Rumi is sharing his personal experiences with us. Why? Because I have surrendered to God. I have made peace with God. Because of that, I have peace in my heart. I am at peace with myself. In my sight, this world is now a paradise. Brothers and sisters, this beautiful world of God can be a paradise if we surrender to the truth. If we surrender to the truth, this natural world will be just a paradise. Rumi attained this paradise in himself. He was living a paradise. Notice how he describes this world in which we live in. The same world that when I, walk around it, I feel miserable. I have all kind of issues with it. You know why? Because there is hell inside me. People who see a lot of issues at the world out there, it's because they have a lot of issues inside. Once these issues are worked out and resolved, we're not going to see any issues outside. Let's listen to Rumi, and then I'm going to close my lecture. So this is the way he views this world. من همی بینم جهان را پر نعیم، آب ها از چشمه ها جوشان مقیم، بانگ آبش میرسد در گوش من، مست میگردد ضمیر و هوش من، شاخه ها رقصان شده چون تایبان، برگ ها کف زن مثال مطربان. I see the world to be full of bounty, the waters constantly gushing from the springs. The noise of their water is coming into my ear. My inner consciousness and intelligence are being intoxicated. I see the boughs dancing like repenters, the leaves clapping their hands like musicians. Can you picture that? Have you ever looked at a tree in that light? That like the branches are clapping like musicians? That's what Rumi saw when he observed a tree. Why? Because he had surrendered and he had made peace with God. He had harmonized himself with this world at large. So in a nutshell, the more inner peace we have, the more we are at peace with everybody else in the world out there, that is a good sign of surrender. I have more to talk, but I know that it's time for Maghrib prayer and breaking our fast. I know that probably most of you were super tired. I want to appreciate your coming here tonight and listening to me so patiently. God bless you all. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.